Good morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Reed Rubenstein, Greenberg Charg for the appellant. I'm joined today by my partner, Mark Solomons, who will be arguing the Information Equality Act matters with respect to this case. The principal question before the court is whether the agency has properly applied the plain language of FETRA. This is not, as the district court ruled, a deference case. Agency doesn't seem to claim deference, does not argue that FETRA has gaps that need to be filled or that appellant challenges a Chevron policy choice. It has attributed its acts to congressional compulsion, not administrative determinations. And frankly, at bottom, FETRA is clear and unambiguous, and deference is therefore improper regardless.
What do we know about the legislative history of this statute?
The legislative history is extremely sparse. It was part of a larger bill, this particular provision, 7 U.S.C. 518D. There's really nothing in the hearings or record that explained.
So we can't know why Congress decided to provide a different way of measuring cigars and cigarettes from other tobacco products?
Well, there's nothing that I can point to in a legislative history that would show that. The language is clear. I think the reason they've done that, you have to look at the historic context. This is a product that's been highly regulated for many, many years. The statutory terms, the rules of engagement, as if it were between the agency and the regulated community, were very clear to everybody, have been for a long time.
I thought your argument there was that Congress had traditionally treated cigars and cigarettes by poundage as opposed to stick, and it's only in the excise tax context that it's used this stick counting mechanism.
Well, for example, the way that the Congress has distinguished between large and small cigars is based on pounds. The context in which this particular provision was enacted related to the phase-out of price supports for tobacco. Growers were paid in pounds. I think there's a practical question here, which is that cigars and cigarettes are sold by stick, whereas pipe tobacco, for example, you go and you buy a pouch.
I'm just trying to understand what Congress had in mind here. I mean, the 11th Circuit says, you know, this is a perfectly rational way of looking at it. You know, so the challenge there failed. And I'm just trying to understand, why would Congress single out cigarettes and cigars in this context?
Well, again, I think it's a very practical reason, is that the way that the tobacco was sold for purposes of calculating market share, and I think it's important to maintain the distinction between gross domestic volume, which is a separately defined term and measures one thing, and market share, which measures something again. The reason that we argue so strongly that this statute is plain and unambiguous is because, really, if you walk through the language the way that Congress wrote it and look at the scheme, it's very clear. There's an initial allocation between the classes of tobacco. It's based on gross domestic volume. And, in fact, that's the way, by the way, that the agency made the allocation. And if you look at in the Federal Register, 70 Federal Register 7008, there's a table that we have provided that shows how this was done.
What do you do with G3?
The section that provides that that the number of cigars shall be the metric for market share?
Yes.
Apply it as it's written. That applies to market share, but that's a different concept than gross domestic volume.
Well, I'm looking at the statute, and I look at E1, talking about pro rata basis.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it talks about gross domestic volume.
Yes.
And then I go over to G, and it's talking about determination of volume of domestic sales. And
yes.
I go down to sub 3, and it tells me how I'm to determine that for cigars and cigarettes.
Yes, but
and the government says, end of discussion.
Well, and that's a very, I think, a very creative interpretation, and it's the only one they can make in order to justify what they have done in this particular case. The problem with that interpretation is that In subsection A, where you have the definition of gross domestic volume and market share, you will see they are two separate concepts. And if you are going to take this metric, the measurement metric for volume of domestic sales, which relates to market sales, the market share, I should say, and then apply it to gross domestic volume, and what you have in effect done is read gross domestic volume right out of the statute. And that creates a whole series of interpretive problems, very serious interpretive problems internally. For example,
I don't understand that. I mean, if you just look at the text, why isn't the government correct? I mean, Congress has given you these broad statements, but then it comes very specifically and homes in on cigars and cigarettes and says this is the way the gross domestic volume is to be measured.
No, Your Honor, it says this is the way that volume of domestic sales is to be measured, and volume of domestic sales relates to market share. Market share is not the same thing as gross domestic volume. I draw your attention to the definitional section, where you have under sub 2 definition of gross domestic volume, and then under
3 where it says the volumes of domestic sales shall be measured by.
Yes, volumes of domestic sales relates specifically to market share, which
right.
is defined as the share of each manufacturer or importer of a class of tobacco product. Gross domestic volume is a different term. That relates to the volume of tobacco products, and they are applied differently. These terms are used differently to do different things within the statute. And to conflate the two.
But Congress has conflated the two, hasn't it?
Not at all.
Look at sub 2. It says the volume of domestic sales shall be calculated based on the gross domestic volume.
That's correct. In all cases, it is important to come back to gross domestic volume. Mm-hmm. That is the only way that this statute makes sense. Historically, that's how the market's been treated. Gross domestic volume is an accepted metric. And if I could draw your attention, Your Honor, to section I sub 4, mm-hmm. where the agency is directed to ensure that each manufacturer and importer pays only its correct pro rata share of total gross domestic volume from all sources.
But the statute doesn't tell us how to calculate the shares of gross domestic volume, though, does it? It tells us that's one of the statutory caps, but it doesn't tell us how to calculate that.
Well, it says you calculate it based on the volume of removals. And volume, and we explore this at great length, the volume has an ordinary meaning, and it's not number.
Three follows two. Gross domestic volume is two, and three says measurement. It's referring back to the volume. I mean, use volume, it uses volume again.
That's correct. Volume is not number, Your Honor.
It uses number. The A is number. The way you determine the volume, it says, in the case of cigarettes and cigars, the number of cigarettes and cigars.
With respect to volume of domestic sales and market share, but not with respect to the cap that the statute places on assessments. The statute specifically says, repeatedly, that no manufacturer is supposed to pay more than their pro rata share of gross domestic volume. And the language that
itself itself means nothing, because you still have to have a measurement.
The measurement is, and the statute provides you that metric, it's volume of removals, which is accepted. Again, if you look in the context of the whole statute, this is the way that Congress has handled this, it's understood that volume means volume. The difference between large cigars and small cigars, for example, is based on the volume of tobacco in the sticks.
Volumes obviously does not mean volumes, because 3 and A together make it clear that the measure of volumes with respect to cigarettes and cigars is the number of cigarettes and cigars.
But, Your Honor, unless you apply a unitary metric to all tobacco, how then would the Secretary ever be able to determine whether a manufacturer has paid more than its total gross domestic volume from all sources? Unless you're going to say there's one gross domestic volume means one thing with respect to pipe tobacco, and a different thing altogether with respect to cigars, which is not what Congress said.
I asked about what Congress had in mind and whether we had any legislative history. And you basically say there's no legislative history to tell us why Congress would single out cigars and cigarettes in this manner, given the other language in the statute that you're relying on. You're saying, in effect, that you have to ignore G3
Not at all. What we're saying is that there was a three-step process that the agency should have followed with respect to cigars, and this applies only with respect to cigars. Cigarettes contain a uniform amount of tobacco.
But under your step three, doesn't that undercut step two?
Not at all.
Why not?
Because all it does is require the agency to, in effect, correct for the gross disparity in volume between small cigars and large cigars, so that you obtain a unitary measure that applies across all products, one standard for all products. Your Honor, the fact of the matter is that, again, this issue that we're dealing with applies only to cigars, and that's only because cigars, unlike all other forms of tobacco, unlike all of the other classes of tobacco, contain different amounts of tobacco in the product that's sold to consumers. And the way that Congress protected, actually, manufacturers such as the appellant in this case, is to specifically state over and over again that no manufacturer shall be required to pay more than its pro rata share of gross domestic volume of all tobacco. That's the control. That's the protection. I see I've exhausted my time.
Who's making the argument between you on the failure to look at the information you've identified?
I will be, Your Honor. Mr. Solomons will be speaking to the information quality.
Can you say a word on that, please? Yeah.
Certainly. The Congress specifically authorized manufacturers to rely on third-party sales data. During the hearing, the appellant in this case introduced voluminous sales data from A.C. Nielsen, demonstrating that it had been overassessed using the metric applied by the agency, market share.
Taking the agency on its own terms.
Absolutely. However, the agency would not disclose the information it used to develop the denominator, so to speak, that was used to calculate our assessment. We had no way to check it.
They said they simply ignored the contention.
They said that because the data was not consistent with the secret data that they relied on, therefore they would not consider it, which we've argued seems to be a bit anomalous given that Congress specifically authorized us to rely on it. Obviously, they don't have to rely on methodologically flawed data, but there was no showing that our data was anything other than what we believed it to be, which is the best available measure. And that, again, gets us.
Your argument essentially is that they've given no justification for refusing to consider your data as against whatever it is.
The justification they gave was that it was not, that the data set that we submitted was not, in fact, I can't remember the exact adjective, consistent or identical to the data they were letting. Synonymous, thank you, Your Honor. But again, Congress said we could rely on this, and the agency told us we could not see their raw data. Right. We didn't care what the market share of our competitors was. What we cared was how they were calculating our number, and we never got that information.
The agency said you had all that information.
We did not, Your Honor. What the agency said, I think, is that even if we had it, it wouldn't have changed anything. But what we know is that in the first instance, the number, the market that they used to aggregate the number of sticks for purposes of calculating our number was wrong, that they had left out 300 companies from the calculation. They went back, added the 300 companies, didn't change our number, the number of sticks we sold, but somehow 300 more companies in the denominator, numerator stays the same, our assessments go up. Clearly, there's a problem, whether it's a problem with the data, whether it's a problem with the method they use to verify the data, the calculation, I can't tell you because they didn't show us. And that, again, rolls into the due process issue that we raised. Okay. Again, we're not claiming the right to win, but we're claiming a right not to lose without a fair hearing, which we were not granted. Okay. I would ask now that Mr. Solomon, the court would.
Good morning. I'm going to address the Information Quality Act issue. And the Supreme Court's always telling us that language matters, and so let's start with the language of the statute. This law requires that each covered federal agency establish an administrative mechanism to allow affected parties to seek and obtain a correction of information that is maintained and disseminated by the agency that does not comply with quality guidelines. Quality guidelines are defined in the statute to include standards, scientific and statistical quality standards.
You say this is an APA claim.
Yes, I do.
All right. So what provision under 706 are you resting on? What is it that you think they've done wrong?
Well, they've taken what they did is nothing.
I want to know under 706 okay. precisely, which part of 706 in the APA are you relying on?
I believe we're relying on 701 or 702, but in 702 it says a person suffering legal wrong because of agency action or adversely affected or aggrieved by agency action within the meaning of a relevant statute is entitled to judicial review thereof. In 702.
You've got to have a cause of action.
Well, I believe that...
What is it? 706 lists the possibilities. The only other one is failure to act or unnecessary delay. You're not suggesting that, as far as I can tell. So well, what is it in 706? 706.1 is compel agency action unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed, and then you have all the rest. What?
Well, it's to compel agency action.
Arbitrary and capricious, or is it a constitutional right? Is it excessive jurisdiction? What?
Well, they did. We filed an application under this statute. They did nothing, and therefore.
No, wait. Come on. The cause of action, you say, is not the statute. It's the APA.
Correct.
Look to 706.
No, Your Honor. The APA provides a right to judicial review. The cause of action arises from the underlying statute and the Information Quality Act, which says we have a right to seek and obtain.
The APA provides what?
It provides the right to judicial review.
Jurisdictional?
No.
No, of course not. 1331 is the jurisdiction.
Right, but this provides the right to judicial review. We don't have a jurisdictional problem here.
Right. And so what's the nature of the wrong?
To compel agency action unlawfully withheld. We sought a correction in data that was maintained by this agency, and they refused to act upon it.
Okay,
refusal
so
to
Norton
act.
Norton and other cases say if you're resting on 706.1, you have to point to some specific point that was denied to you. What is the specific thing that the statute gives you as a legal entitlement that you've been denied?
They denied us the right to seek and obtain a correction in the data that was maintained.
Now, where is it in the Information Quality Act that says you have a right to a correction as opposed to the statute merely indicating that the Office of Management and Budget will implement guidelines and that the agency will follow those guidelines?
Well, you know, this language either has meaning or it doesn't, and I think that the
it does have meaning.
Right, and the language here is
right.
This law requires, this is in paragraph 2, it's in the note here, it requires that each federal agency to which these guidelines apply, which includes this one, establish administrative mechanisms, which they didn't do, allowing affected person, which is us, and most of the certainly the Supreme Court's cases that talk about the questions relating to standing to seek this or the creation of a right.
It says that's, OMB will issue guidelines that require each federal agency to which the guidelines apply to issue guidelines ensuring and maximizing the quality, objectivity, utility, and integrity of information. Now, where do you get
well, Your Honor,
action?
You know, I'm not reading that section. I'm reading B, which follows A.
Establish administrative mechanisms. That's what
they didn't do that.
Do they have anything?
No, not that
Wait, now, let's start with the first problem you have, if I recall correctly. The content of OMB's guidelines exclude adjudicatory actions.
Right, but we didn't have an adjudication of this issue at all. This is a 12B6 on this, a 12B6 dismissal.
No, this wasn't
raised.
The agency had an adjudicatory action. The agency's action was an adjudication, as that term of art is understood. Let me finish so you understand my question. The agency acted pursuant to an adjudication. The OMB guidelines say that whatever it is federal agencies have to do, they don't have to establish guidelines for adjudications. So you're not even within the compass of what the OMB guidelines require.
I disagree with you for a number of reasons. First of all, this wasn't raised below, and so we didn't have the opportunity to explain how we would not.
It was a summary judgment.
It was 12B6.
It was a summary judgment issued by the district court.
It was a 12B6 on this issue.
You had an opportunity. We take this matter as a matter of first impression coming from the agency. The agency raised it. You had an opportunity to respond.
They did not raise it below. We addressed it.
The below doesn't matter here because we review an agency action as if the district court didn't exist. So the question is whether you've had an opportunity to respond to them. You have had an opportunity.
No, my answer is we did not have an opportunity to respond.
The reply brief wasn't adequate?
They gave us no opportunity to address the errors that we perceive in their data.
On the point about OMB excluding adjudicatory matters from the compass of the guidelines, you were on notice once in this court that the agency raised that. We read this record as if the district court has done nothing.
Your Honor, let me...
So now you had an opportunity. So let's assume it's not waived, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I understand your argument on waiver. Let's assume it's not waived. Do you have an answer on that?
I certainly do.
What is it?
The remedy that we would have under the Information Quality Act is not the same remedy that we would have under the... under FETRA. The remedy that we have
is the OMB guidelines.
No, but I'm saying we don't get an adjudication on the remedy that we're seeking under this.
You're missing the point. The OMB guidelines say they do not apply to agency adjudications.
But we're not seeking an agency adjudication. Your Honor, what you're suggesting is, if I understand the concept, is that any agency which has an adjudication which is related to any of this can oust the information quality. It just repeals it.
In other words,
we're trying to figure out what is required by this. This statute only says that OMB will promulgate guidelines, and agencies must follow those guidelines and promulgate guidelines. But the OMB guidelines, which are overriding, say they do not apply to agency adjudications. Is that unlawful?
Well, it may be, but presumably they would apply to an adjudication if it was an adjudication that provided the same relief that the IQA provides. And we're saying, first of all, we never had an opportunity to develop this at trial. We could have developed it at trial. And what I'm saying here is that it is not the same relief. Therefore, the adjudication doesn't apply to us.
All right. So the agency says this only applies to information that is disseminated by the agency. That's the second argument.
Well, we alleged in our complaint it was disseminated. They never said it wasn't. They have never put any proof that it wasn't. We believe it was. I think they conceded that it was. And so I don't know. I mean,
be clear, what is the information that you think is incorrect?
Oh, the information.
Finish. Okay. What is the information you think is incorrect?
The information that we think is incorrect is described in our application to the USDA, and it includes the data, the industry-wide data on gross domestic volume, the industry-wide data on the per stick count, and the individual data that relates to us.
When did they disseminate that information?
Well, I believe they disseminated. I'm not real strong on this. I mean, I believe that this information is disseminated in the course of these proceedings, but also that they admitted that the information was disseminated in the case below. So I think that, essentially what you have here is a situation where the agency provides, they haven't raised any of these issues until now that you've addressed here. But the fact of the matter is that
is a question if the law makes that relevant. What I tried to suggest to you is that in agency cases, we take the case anew. That's old law.
I understand that.
Circuit. So the question is whether now, before us, the issue has been joined. And I thought it was joined because they raised it and you responded. So the issue's been joined.
Your Honor, there are factual questions that are raised by both of these issues about both dissemination and whether we get the same remedy that were not, because they weren't raised below, we did not have an opportunity at an appropriate time to address those questions with factual information. These are not strictly questions of law. Whether something is disseminated or whether a remedy is four square on point are questions which need a factual build-out, and we didn't have the opportunity to do that because those issues were not raised below. I mean, what
we retried agency cases when they came to federal court. I thought we accepted
the record
as is presented. You don't retry an agency.
There's no record because they didn't do anything.
Well, that's your argument has to be based on the record, and then you'll win or lose on whatever claims you have to make with respect to the record.
Your Honor, the APA covers inaction to the same degree it covers agency action. And what you have here, when the agency...
In your 706-1 argument, and the question is, we're going around in circles. And the 706-1 argument is, to what specific right are you referring that you've been denied?
Norton says you have to
point to something specifically.
We are an affected person who sought a correction in information, and we were not given an opportunity under this statute to get it. And
what at least one judge is saying to you is, I hear that assertion, and then I'm looking at the statute, which is right in front of me, and I don't know where you get that from.
Well,
it says you're an affected person, and you have a right to obtain correction of information. It says, rather, that OMB will establish guidelines that the agencies have to follow. One of the things that those guidelines will pertain to is effective administrative mechanisms. That's not the same as saying you have a right under a federal statute to come in and claim a correction of information. They're completely different things. Completely different things.
Well, I mean,
If you would come in and argue that they didn't establish what the law required, then maybe there's an interesting question. I don't know. But you seem to think that you can go from this statute to a claim that you can demand information, and I don't know where that comes from.
Well, I think, I mean, I read this. It says that I mean, if in parsing the words of this statute, it says OMB will establish guidelines, and then each agency is going to do their own guidelines. The guidelines are designed not to necessarily facilitate this process, but to identify the criteria for determining when agency information that is disseminated is sufficiently correct so that it doesn't require another look by the agency. And that's what this provision logically means. And that's what we didn't cite a lot of legislative history on this, but this is what the legislative history indicates. So they're not concerned about some kind of internal government stuff. They don't need to do anything internally to affect the way OMB deals with an agency. But this provision, if you read the provision that way, then B is gone because the agency would never have to do anything like they did here.
All right. Let us hear from the agency.
May it please the court, Sydney Foster for Thomas Vilsack and the Department of Agriculture.
Can you do me a favor just because it's easier for me? I won't have to think so hard. Start where we left off.
Okay, sure.
Also come back to the statute.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Then
we'll definitely
come back to the statute. Don't mean to suggest otherwise. Curiosity. Has the agency established any administrative mechanisms?
The agency has established an administrative.
Has or has not?
It has.
Right.
And if the website has those mechanisms on it, if you go to the link that's provided on our website, there's not a direct link to the part that covers the administrative processes, but there's on the right-hand side of the webpage, there's something that says something about like seeking an administrative correction. So I'm not sure where the assertion that there was no such process set up comes from.
You are asserting to us that there is a process that has been established pursuant to B2B.
Correct.
That affected parties might invoke in situations in which they feel they have a claim.
That is correct. And there have been other such submissions, and as required by the statute, USDA reports to OMB about the nature and number of such petitions for correction. So there absolutely is.
The claim here is not that there was a failed use of that procedural mechanism.
I'm sorry.
And the claim here is not that the agency failed to allow these parties to use that mechanism. Is that right?
The claim, as I understand it, is that plaintiff wishes that there had been a response that was direct, that was styled as a response to the IQA request. There was a FOIA request that was made on the very same day.
No, but as to Judge Edwards' question, isn't their precise point that they were denied the opportunity under this statute to use the mechanism, whatever it is, because the agency just ignored its request?
I think that's right, that that's their claim.
All right, yeah.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to understand.
Right, I think that's their claim. I think that that whatever rights that FETRA, or sorry, that the IQA gives them, they've had an opportunity to pursue those rights under the FOIA and under the procedures under FETRA. They submitted a FOIA request for information that was denied.
I don't understand that.
I'm trying to understand. There is a mechanism that must be established. The must is with a question mark. Administrative mechanism in place.
Correct.
Did they attempt to use it? Were they denied the opportunity to use it? What?
Plaintiff did attempt to use it, and they were permitted to submit their request and also for correction. It was styled as a request for correction. It was actually more of a request for information. And then they also, when they didn't hear anything back that directly in response to their IQA petition, they did receive a denial of their FOIA request, but when they didn't receive anything in response to their IQA petition, they did follow the procedure set up by the USDA to submit a request for reconsideration, which is also provided in the USDA guidelines. The USDA guidelines actually do not even provide that a direct response is necessary. And here, as your honors have noted, the information that they're seeking to obtain and to correct was the information that was underlying the adjudicatory processes that were ongoing under the FETRA,
but their argument,
and were therefore not covered.
Their argument is that ignore, in effect, the adjudication. Ignore it.
Correct.
They have the right under this statute to come into the agency and saying, I'm putting words in their mouth right now, but you've disseminated certain information about gross domestic volume, and it's erroneous. So we have a right to come in and point that out to you, and the agency has an obligation to tell us what the substantive response is to our assertion.
That's correct. Yes, that's my understanding of their argument. Which highlights that the central problem with the argument, even if they can come to court, which we believe that they can't, to enforce a right under the IQA, the IQA itself covers only disseminated information. OMB guidelines have been very clear that disseminated information does not include information that was disseminated as part of an adjudicatory proceeding.
Your guidelines, adopted pursuant to the OMB guidelines, exclude matters in an adjudication?
Yes. And
that is now the argument, belatedly, that is now the argument you are happy to rest on.
That is correct.
That in an adjudication, there is always review. My understanding of that policy judgment is, OMBs and then the agencies, in an adjudication, you always can secure relevant information and seek arbitrary and capricious or substantial evidence review in the event of a failure of it. And so OMB did not mean to suggest that we're going to create anything more here, and you didn't either.
That is exactly
right. Now that's where you want to happily reside. This is an adjudication, and so whatever the statute means, it doesn't cover this.
That is exactly right. Thank you. If I could turn to the FETRA argument.
A quick informational question.
Sure.
IQA, was it designed by Congress to really address the type of information such as census data that is disseminated by an agency and somebody says you miscounted or something? Is that what this statute is about, is distinct from the adjudicatory procedures that you and Judge Edwards have been talking about?
It is certainly the case that the IQA was not, there's no indication in the legislative history that the IQA was meant to reach the adjudicatory proceedings that we've been talking about.
Was it intended to reach?
There's not much in the legislative history about it. I think it's been understood.
But you've got FOIA, then you have this statute, then you have adjudications, and I'm just wondering what this statute is all about, but we don't need to get into that. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Turning to the FETRA argument, Judge Rogers, you asked a question, which I'd like to try and address, about why the statute might have chosen to treat cigars and cigarettes differently from the other classes. And as opposing counsel said, there isn't much legislative history on this, but I think the answer becomes clear when we look at the fact that these calculations are based on excise tax data.
Well, that's what I was getting at, that that's the only tie I could see.
Yeah, that's right. It's based on the removal into domestic commerce, and the statute specifically provides in Section 518DH that that the calculations shall be made on the basis of tax data. Tax data, excise taxes for tobacco are different for cigars and cigarettes as compared to the rest of the other four classes. For the other four classes, excise taxes are assessed on a based on the amount, the number of pounds of tobacco that are being removed. For cigars and cigarettes, excise taxes are different, and they are by and large assessed based on the number of actual cigars or cigarettes that are removed. There's a small exception for one subcategory of the large cigars, is that the way the excise taxes are calculated for large cigars is that they are based on the number of cigars removed, unless an alternate calculation that's based on the percentage of the price that the cigar is sold for would result in a smaller tax.
So essentially, is it your understanding then that Congress had in mind that the data that was relevant here was going to be excise tax data?
Correct.
Period.
Correct.
And so that the second argument that the parties make about the Nielsen sales data information, even though there is that broader language in the statute about and such other relevant information, is simply irrelevant since this is an excise tax sort of reimbursement scheme?
Yes, that's correct. For the method of calculation under FETRA requires use of the excise tax data, and that is why the agency rejected the AC Nielsen data, because it measures something entirely different. The statute does allow for the submission of third-party data, but that doesn't mean that this third-party data, which the agency noted, measures something different. It isn't measuring removal. It's survey data as well, as opposed to the comprehensive data that the agency relies on.
Well, I'm not real comfortable using legislative history to trump the language of the statute. So let me get back to the language. Let me get you back to the language of the statute a little bit.
Okay.
How should volume be measured in? Is it D14B? That's what my note shows.
D14B.
That's the language where it says the secretary shall make any revisions necessary to
ensure. D-I-4B, I think.
D-I-4B. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. So D-I-4B.
Because my concern with your argument is you don't seem to be giving weight to these statutory caps.
Right.
You want it to be. You say the clear language is the per stick rule, and the per stick rule is definitely there. But I don't see you coming up with an argument for what we're supposed to do with these statutory caps, which are, after all, statutory.
Correct. So I think, so DI-4B, if we read it, it says that on review that the secretary may make any revisions necessary to ensure that each manufacturer or importer pays only its correct pro rata share of the total gross domestic volume from all sources.
How do you figure that
read out? In the context, pardon me?
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead. How do you figure, what is that? How do you calculate that amount?
I think what read in the context of the statute, what that means is that that it's a calculation that's been made on the basis of the formula that the statute lays out, so that it's a calculation that is where the first step, where the assessments are divided to the six classes, is made according to.
You have your market share calculation that's based on per stick, but then the if you, whatever number you get that, it's got to be limited by this. And how do you figure out this?
Yeah, I don't think that this is saying something entirely different from what the other parts of the statute are saying. I think this is just...
It's a limit on the per market. It's a limit on the market share calculation, right? If your market share calculation reveals one number, that number cannot exceed this number. And all I'm asking is, how do you figure out this number? Gross domestic volume from all sources. I think your opposing counsel argues that that's based on weight, which is determined, I think he said, by excise tax. But again, that what's your answer?
Correct. Two answers. Number one is, if we take that understanding, then we read G3 entirely out of the statute on the basis of this I-4B, which is in the section for
identifying. Why do you take it out of the statute? You read them together. And whatever you get with G3 cannot exceed what you get through I-4B. That's not... reading
that
it out.
A difficult, I mean, that would be a creative reading of the statute. I mean, I-4B here is talking about when the secretary, upon review of any challenges, can make any changes. And I think read in that context, this is saying is make adjustments as necessary if anything went wrong in the calculations. For example, here.
Back to the plain language here. G3 mm-hmm. is talking about for purposes of calculation under this subsection.
Correct.
Which I am reading as meaning G.
Uh-huh, only. Correct. Yeah, that's my reading as well.
All right. So then when you come over to I, mm-hmm. you're in another subsection of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, not to put words in my colleague's mouth, but that you don't even refer to the stick count at the point you're at I-4, but rather you're looking at what counsel here today was suggesting was a unitary measure across all products. And that's this language about total gross domestic volume from all sources.
Yeah. I think that would be a strange interpretation of I-4 to kind of impose a third step on top of what is already here. There would be really no reason if that was how we're supposed to be interpreting I-4 for us to engage in this second step at all. Instead, it would be more direct for the statute just to direct that we should do it by weight for all of the classes. So I think read into context, this is just simply saying if there were mistakes in how the assessments were allocated at either step one when they're allocated among the six classes or at step two, which is prescribed in great detail in subsections F and G, that at that point, then changes should be made. And I think saying...
Let me ask you, what's wrong with Judge Griffith's question, the assumption under the question that suppose I'm a small cigar manufacturer, and under G3, if you look at it and compare it with the total gross domestic volume from all sources, clearly it exceeds my share of that. And so this is the cap. And in other situations, it might not exceed the cap. So it's still relevant. It's not read out of the statute. That is G3.
Right. Well, I mean, I think and the other point to make is that the definition of total gross domestic volume as defined in A2, it's not clear what the metric for measuring that is, yeah. And it would be entirely consistent with the statute to read I-4B.
You just said it. It's not clear what it means.
Yes.
What do we do when it's not clear what it means?
Well, when we have the
what do we do when it's not clear what it means, but the agency says it is clear what it means in its actions? Right?
Well, the agency is saying that it's clear that the method for calculating the per stick method is clearly mandated because of the language in F and G.
And, right, but it doesn't address I-4.
I think I-4. I mean, one can interpret I-4B. I think the agency's interpretation of I-4B is that it's simply saying that a manufacturer's correct pro rata share of the total gross domestic volume is a share that was calculated correctly with respect to both steps one and step two of the process, and it's step one. Because excise taxes are measured differently for cigars and cigarettes as opposed to the other four classes, that step one calculation is based on excise taxes because that can be a common.
I understand your argument. Does the agency actually say that? I just thought the agency said G3, end of discussion.
Yeah. That's correct. You mean in the agency opinion?
That's right. They didn't get to this I-4.
I think that they didn't get to I-4 because they didn't see it as altering any component of the statute. I think they saw no reason to address it. That's correct. They don't address it explicitly in the decision.
Well, I mean, so do we know what the secretary thinks?
We do. I mean, the agency very clearly, I mean, has stated in its regulation, the regulation that interprets this statutory provision, has interpreted the statutory scheme as mandating the use of this per stick method and not imposing anything as a result of I-4B on top of what on top of just the use of the per stick method, the preamble to that that was published in the Federal Register when those regulations were published states that the agency believes that that method is mandated by the statute. If this court should think that contrary to the agency's interpretation that the statute is ambiguous, then it should remand to the agency for consideration of how to exercise its discretion. But at this point, the agency believes it's mandated that the statute could not be more clear and has attempted to.
Let me make sure I'm understanding. You're saying that G2 refers to gross domestic volume.
Mm-hmm.
G3 is talking about the measurement of that gross domestic volume.
It's talking about the measurement of the volume of domestic sales. The statute uses the term gross domestic volume and the term volume of domestic sales differently.
Let me make sure I'm really clear on this. Gross domestic volume, termination of volume, domestic sales. And we're talking about gross domestic volume in two. Three is the measurement of something, and I thought measurement of gross domestic volume. Volumes of domestic sales, but it's following under gross domestic volumes. The reason I'm curious about this is because when you go to I-4B, again, you're talking about gross domestic volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's complete symmetry to your argument, if that's what the agency meant to say, that the measurement is about gross domestic volume. 3A explains how you do it, and then 4... And then I-4B merely says if you made a mistake in that, it can be corrected.
Yes.
That's what you're saying the agency meant to say.
I think that's correct. Yes, thank you.
And that the statutory language, just let me be very clear,
mm-hmm.
that when G3 refers to the volumes of domestic sales,
mm-hmm.
that is
what?
Equivalent to
gross
4B's reference to total gross domestic volume from all sources?
That's correct.
And the reason you're saying that is I'm asking.
Mm-hmm.
G2 is about gross domestic volume.
Correct.
And 3 is how you measure that.
Correct.
That's your argument.
Correct. So gross domestic volume, when applied to determining the volume for cigars and cigarettes, is measured by stick. When applied to measuring the other categories, is determined by weight. When gross domestic volume is determined for step one, it is determined according to
I thought gross domestic volume across all sources. How can you use stick to be a unified measurement here?
So I think that's where we get back to step one. So step one of the calculation is where the assessments are, where the agents, the determination is made about how much of the assessment each of the six categories will be responsible for. That the percentage that was allocated to each of the six classes was set by statute for the first year, the year that's at issue here. For subsequent years, the agency essentially mimicked what Congress had done in coming up with those statutes and based those on the excise taxes, because they needed a common metric for all six classes and used excise taxes paid in order to come up with that metric. So for that step one, the gross domestic volume was measured in terms of excise taxes. That was the metric. For step two, the statute very clearly says that the gross domestic volume shall be measured in terms of the number of cigars and cigarettes for those two classes, in terms of the number of pounds for the other two classes. And so when we read I-4B that says that an importer or a manufacturer is only going to pay its correct pro rata share of the total gross domestic volume of all sources, that means in this context where gross domestic volume is being calculated with different metrics at the different steps, is that that manufacturer and importer was responsible for its proportional share according to stick count for for its class, the cigar class, and that the cigar class was responsible only for the proportion that it was that Congress stated that it would be responsible for under the first category, where gross domestic volume is measured according to excise taxes. It's complicated because the statute essentially calls for different measures, metrics for using the gross domestic volume, but having those different measures is entirely consistent with this statutory language in I-4B.
That, but if you can step back, and this may not be fair to you, and I understand that, but help me if you can. the excise tax, viewed independently, distinguishes between large and small cigars.
That's correct.
So that there is no penalty, as it were, for being a small cigar manufacturer based on number of sticks.
That's correct.
Now, in this statute, as part of the argument that I understand appellants to be making in terms of the unfairness of the agency's interpretation, is that, in effect, they will end up being responsible for more than their pro rata share of gross domestic volume from all sources as compared to the large cigar manufacturers. So that, in effect, this is like a penalty that's being imposed on them that Congress couldn't have intended. There's nothing in the statute to suggest that Congress put this I-4B in so that the Secretary could correct these type of inequities by having this cap.
Correct. There's no evidence that there was meant to be some kind of third step that is a cap. I think this...
No, but there's no evidence that there was meant to be a penalty in my hypothetical that I'm giving to you.
No, that's true as well.
In other words, just because I'm a small cigar manufacturer doesn't mean I ought to pay more of this transition into this transition fund than my pro rata share of gross domestic volume.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right, though I think as the 11th Circuit held in Swisher, where the 11th Circuit
just
started...
rational.
Right, they said, right, but it could be rational for Congress to have determined that it would have been more administrative.
They didn't deal with any of these complexities that we're dealing with, really,
in that
opinion. Whether it was presented to them, to the 11th Circuit or not, I don't know, but the opinion itself doesn't deal with
correct.
Judge Griffith, Judge Edwards, and I are talking about.
Correct. My point was simply that one of the reasons that Swisher noted that the statute was rational was it noted that it could have been rational for Congress to have determined that calculations would be, you know, simpler if the distinction between large and small cigars was not made under FETRA in the same way that it is made in light of the clear text.
I think that they did go that far, but they didn't deal with I-4. Yeah.
They could have told us how to calculate gross domestic volume from all sources.
Right. I mean, I think the way to reconcile the I-4B is to understand where it fits in the context. It's
but
not
your,
in
your
the...
Your reading of it, why didn't Congress just use the phrase market share? That's you're saying that's what I-4B means, but that's not the language they used.
I think I-4B is meant to capture if there were any problems in step one or in step two, and market share is the term that's used only for step two. I-4B is all it's about is allowing for corrections. This is after the statute has already gone through this very precise description of how
it's
calculations should be
corrections,
made.
But it lets the cigar manufacturer know what their maximum liability is going to be here. I mean, it's another source of the cap that the statute imposes on their liability, right?
I don't believe that that's right. I think that read in context, since it is in this review section, that when it says the correct pro rata share of the total gross domestic volume, it's saying that ensuring that those first two steps of the calculation were done correctly.
You're saying I is what it is, challenge to assessment. The assessment
exactly.
is described elsewhere.
Exactly.
There's no substantive provision in I. I doesn't reassess the assessment.
Precisely.
I mean, that's your claim.
Yes, precisely. If the court has no further questions, we ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Just one second. Let me just check, if I may, my notes here. I thought there was a fourth issue. Oh, yes, the secret data burden argument.
Mm-hmm.
That is an argument they make.
Yes, the due process argument?
That's right, that the burden was placed on them.
Yes, they contend the information that they had available to them was they knew how many cigars had been attributed to them by the agency. They knew the total number of cigars that the agency had determined had been removed into domestic commerce, and then they knew the relevant math that was related to that. What they didn't have available to them was the tax return data that was submitted by their competitors that would allow them to ensure that that information was correct for their competitors, and that indeed that information, that the number of cigars removed by their competitors plus their amount for them added up to that total number that was in the denominator. That information, they sought under a FOIA request, but that information was denied to them because it is protected by the tax confidentiality statute 26 U.S.C. 6103. It wouldn't have allowed them to do anything more than to ensure that the agency had correctly gleaned information from tax returns and then added a series of numbers together. And due process certainly does not require that level of access to information, particularly in light of these confidentiality concerns that are on the other side of the ledger. And they cite no case that's remotely similar, suggesting that due process does impose such a requirement.
Could I just be clear? If hypothetically in this world there are 1,000 manufacturers and importers of tobacco,
yes,
would they have known that there were 1,000? Because, in the original correction that the agency made, it said, well, we left out some, and then others were exempt from the excise tax and therefore were exempt under this statute.
Correct. I think as of the time that this appeal, the assessments at issue here took place, they did not have that information.
They didn't know about 1,000.
They would now know that because there's been a revision
right.
to.
But in other words, if I am a manufacturer and I receive this assessment from the secretary that I owe X number of dollars under this FEDRA, then I can seek a hearing from the secretary, but I have no basis for knowing anything more than my information, my tax information, et cetera. But I have no idea whether, the other 999 manufacturers are included in the denominator here?
You don't know the number of companies that are in the denominator. The one piece of information that's more useful that you do know is the Department of Treasury's the Alcohol and Tax Bureau of publishes its statistics about the number of cigars that are removed. I think it's on a monthly basis they publish their statistics, which you would then be able to use to gauge the accuracy of that denominator. The numbers aren't exactly identical because there are some companies who are required to report to the Tax and Trade Bureau of the Department of Treasury who are not covered under these assessments. But that would give you a measure, and the plaintiff has never, to my knowledge, contended that there's something wrong, amiss with the size of the denominator on the basis of comparing it with that Tax and Trade Bureau data, which is really more relevant than the actual number of companies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, with respect to the data, as we point out, there are some very obvious discrepancies, and it's really not appropriate for the agency to simply say we should just take it and be quiet. It doesn't give us much of a real appeal right. With respect to the definition of gross domestic volume, I've heard it defined about four different ways today. We've heard it defined as in G3. We've heard it defined in G2. We've heard it defined as excise tax data. What it is what is written in the statute. And it is something different than market share. And apropos of Judge Edwards' point with respect to the cap, it is a cap, and it does not just appear in ID4. If you take
also
a look,
DE as well.
I'm sorry. If you take a look right. At 518 DE, specifically says.
But that doesn't have the phrase from all sources.
The phrase, all sources. Right. It applies across all sources. The definition in the statute is very broad. Mm-hmm. The definition of gross domestic volume is volume removals. That's it. To suggest that G3 somehow modifies or changes that definition of gross domestic volume has no support within the four corners of the statute. If you read the language.
What is G3 about, though?
G3 is about volume of domestic sales, which relates to market share. market share.
What is it needed for in the context of this statute? It's under a section, subsection headed measurement. What do you need it for? Why is it there?
Section G is titled Determination of Volume of Domestic Sales. If you go back to the definition of market share.
The problem is we've got gross domestic volume in here, too. I understand what you're saying, and the problem here is the statute is using those terms back and forth. Determination of volume domestic sales and then gross domestic volume is under that subsection.
Yeah, and I think the
then you go back to volumes of domestic sales again. And to what end? What is that for?
Your Honor, let me suggest the following solution. The in all cases, the statute says come back to gross domestic volume, volume removals. Now, we talked about how excise tax was used to calculate shares between the different classes, and that's why I emphasize the table. Apropos of your question, Judge Griffin, how do you measure gross domestic volumes?
No, come back to my question.
Well, and
I'd like to know what it is that G3 is about then. Why is it there?
Because the purpose of this is to measure market share.
Well, what purpose?
In order to allocate within the classes. Remember, there's the assessment between classes, and then within classes, there's an allocation between companies. This relates to the allocation, the intra-class allocation. Now, we're not saying the sick count.
And whatever that figure is, it's limited by the shares of gross domestic volume from all sources.
Precisely. We're not saying stick count does not have a role to play, but the agency cannot just count sticks and leave it at that. Gross domestic volume, we heard about excise taxes, and if you look at the chart that we cited, that the agency put together, it has line items for large cigarettes and small cigarettes. There are no large cigarettes sold in the United States. It got a zero. Has small cigarettes. Small cigarettes contain a uniform amount of tobacco. It has line items for small cigars and large cigars. And as I noted,
I'm just curious, what's a large cigarette? Not being a smoker myself.
I'm sorry, I couldn't tell
you. Sorry.
It's based on the volume of tobacco in the stick. And as I suggest, the distinction between large and small cigars is made based on the amount of tobacco in the sticks. So the excise tax is a marker, and the agency said we're going to use excise tax as a marker for volume. So we have a single metric, and so we can comply with the statute. The agency knows how to do this. There needs to be a harmonious interpretation of the statute that uses all of the language and all of its provisions.
Where is the category large and small sticks?
If you look, Your Honor, at 70 Federal Register.
In the statute?
In the Federal Register. Where the agency was making the allocations between classes for purposes of complying with the statute. It provided a table for calculation of initial assessments. And this appears on page 7008 of 70 CFR, dates February 10th, 2005. And on the left-hand side, there's line items for cigarettes small, cigarettes large, cigars small, cigars large, snuff, chewing tobacco, pipe tobacco, roll your own. That's what's regulated under FETRA. And then it gives you different measures, so including the tax rate. And then the last column is titled allocation by class percentage. And the agency divided allocations between large and small cigars based on tax rate because that's a marker for volume. That's the marker, that's the measure of gross domestic volume. We heard it as the agency said that gross domestic volume is measured by excise tax because that's a marker according to the agency of volume of tobacco. And that's how you make this statute make sense and apply all of its provisions. It's really the only way.
We don't know that from the language of the statute, though, do we? You're saying we know that because that's the custom.
I think we do know it from the language of the statute because it defines.
You measure gross domestic value by excise tax?
And by large and small, we don't see that.
Well, the agency's. Well, no, but what we have, though, again, we have this three-step process, and the third step has to be, the control has to be, that there is no assessment on a company that is allowed to exceed its pro rata share of gross domestic volume, not its market share, not the volume of domestic sales, but gross domestic volume.
Because we don't know. We have to figure out what gross domestic
volume is. I'm with you until that last part, yeah.
Well, you're stating as if it's obvious. It's not. That's the question.
Well,
gross domestic volume.
The statute defines it as volume of removals. And as we suggest, volume is an ordinary meaning, and it isn't number. Again, we're not saying stick count doesn't play a role. It does. Just the agency needed to take a third step, which it actually had done, as shown by this chart.
I mean, just so you understand, it's not as easy as you say, because volume does not always mean what you're saying, because in 3, it talks about 3 and 3A, it talks about volumes in terms of sticks, because it says volumes. Whether I understand it says volumes of domestic sales, but it's volumes. And so the notion of volumes never being a stick count is wrong, because the statute clearly does make volumes in some circumstances measured by stick counts.
I appreciate
you
the interpretive
appreciate
issue.
It.
No, Your Honor, believe me, I have spent a lot of time on this.
I'm not making it up.
I understand, Your Honor. But again, I think you have to read the whole statute. And again, we've got this issue.
Well,
of,
I mean, the one thing, the only thing that maybe you both have convinced us on is there's no plain meaning in this statute. I don't know where that takes us, but there's certainly not plain meaning.
For reasons I talked about and in our brief, I disagree. If I could just have two words with respect to your Information Quality Act questions, Judge Edwards. You asked about the adjudicatory proceeding information. The information request, and it's in the appendix, and I would draw your attention to it, does not ask for adjudicatory information. What it specifically asked for was information related to data and methods relating to essentially the calculation of the denominator, calculation of market share. In fact, it was sent months before there was any kind of proceeding.
But it would be relevant to the matter adjudicated.
Any tax bill would be, I suppose, relevant to a matter of dispute.
But I mean, I think you're deadly serious. That's the point, I think, that OMB, if they were here and explaining what they had in mind, would say. If this is related to or relevant to what is being adjudicated, you have an opportunity to request the information in that context.
That, Your Honor, I think that's problematic. I mean, if they were here today, what we have is what they wrote when they promulgated the OMB guidelines.
Well, what they wrote was not a cause of action of the sort that you're talking about. So the question is there something within the guidelines, within the regulatory guidelines that you say were in play that gives you more?
Well,
that's the only place you can get something is in the agency's regulatory guidelines, and your argument would have to be that they didn't follow their guidelines and give you what it is they say you're entitled to.
Well, I think that's
precisely. That's all you have.
I think that's precisely the argument. I would draw your attention to the OMB guidelines, 67 Federal Register, pages 8455 to 57, where
it lays it out. What are the pages?
8455 through 8457.
Thanks.
Where OMB discusses what the IQA is about. And as we say in our request, it was enacted to ensure that government information is objective and supported by statistically sound data and that the public has meaningful access to the data and methods. That's, I think, in a nutshell, addresses the questions that you raised.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.